You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking American League East with MLB.com's AL East beat reporters. With the Orioles, we'll be talking about the scuffles with the Blue Jays and what's going on with their rotation. With the Blue Jays, we'll be talking about the scuffles with the Orioles and why they hit so well at home. We'll be looking at the Yankee rotation and talking a little A-Rod. We'll be talking about the Red Sox offense and Mookie Betts. And we'll be giving some more injury updates on those Tampa Bay Rays and looking at how maybe that lineup gets going. Ian, in looking at Red Sox stats, and again, I can be guilty of scouting the stats, but that's why I ask you these things. Red Sox are tied for last in the major leagues in extra base hits. And on my notes, all I have written down after that note is, what?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. The thing is, the team is winning, but they're not necessarily doing it in pretty ways right now. You know, they're sort of grinding it out. You have a bunch of guys who aren't really in a rhythm offensively. Hanley Ramirez has hit a few three-run homers, so that's made some things look good. But, yeah, they're not in a groove right now offensively. I think it's just early season, frankly, and guys just not clicking. But I do think, you know, I'm convinced that this team is going to hit, but you just kind of have a bunch of guys off the slow starts at once.
There certainly are some guys you fully expect to hit. But there are also some guys coming off some trouble that maybe you're not so sure about. I mean, I look at a guy like Victorino. I know everybody was really encouraged about Napoli, but he didn't have a great year last year. Any of these guys off to early slumps that there is concern about, that maybe it is a little more than just a slow 2 weeks?
It's funny with Napoli. This guy had a magnificent spring training, and he just looked kind of like he was going to have a huge year. And I think what happened was they went to Philadelphia. They didn't have that DH, and he ended up sitting 2 out of 3 games. And it seemed like he really lost his stroke in that 1 week to start the season. And he's been sort of trying to get it back ever since. But, you know, again, I think that these guys go in streaks. And sometimes the guys who are red hot in spring training are the guys who start off slow during the season. So I think it's just that with Mike Napoli. Shane Victorino, you know, he sort of predicted he was going to get off to a slow start because he said, look, I missed, you know, almost the entire second half of last year. It's going to take me a while to get my timing back. So let's just wait. I would wait a couple of weeks on that just to make sure if that's exactly what it is, just kind of regaining his feel for the game. He's looked pretty good on defense. He seems to be moving around pretty well in right field. But, yeah, he's definitely off to a terrible start offensively, and you're not going to feel great about him until you start seeing Victorino get some of those results.
Another guy I kind of want to drill down on a little more that we were just raving about either 1 or 2 weeks ago. But Mookie Betts is hitting 200 with a 262 on base. He's hit for some power. He's got 4 extra base hits. But he's not performance-wise off to a great start. And so, you know, as somebody who's watching him more than I am, what are you seeing from him? Are the numbers deceiving, or is he really off to a little bit of a slow start? Big highlights and big moments aside.
Yeah, I think he's trying to find it a little bit right now at the plate, and he's the classic case of a 22-year-old kid who was red hot when he came up last year, and in spring training this year, now guys have a book on him, and they're trying to exploit some weaknesses, and now, you know, he's going to make that next adjustment. But by no means does he look overmatched at the plate. he's taking good swings. He's hit a lot of balls. Right at guys, and he continues to play winning baseball, such as, you know, Tropicana Field, first game of the series there. Great takeout slide, really, to set up the only run of the game the Red Sox had there. He's made a number of great plays on defense. So I think this guy is, you know, he'll get hot. He'll get hot. He's too good of an athlete, and, you know, too much poise up there not to get his number soon. It's just, like I said, you know, everybody reads into the slumps that happen the first 2 weeks of the season, because that's all you have on your stat sheet right now. And if Mookie goes through a stretch like this, you know, in June, where he's already built up a foundation of numbers, you know, nobody's even talking about it. So I think it's just, you know, the way you read into things early in the season.
Given the glut of outfielders they have, is there any pressure on either of those guys just because there are so many alternatives? If they decided to give a guy, even if it wasn't a full-on change of a regular, to start trying to get somebody some more at-bats, is there any particular pressure on Betts or Victorino just again, given that there are 1,000 alternatives?
Yeah, no, I think Mookie's a guy in center, kind of almost no matter what. I mean, unless he has like a Jackie Bradley junior season from last year, I think Mookie's going to be the guy in center. But, yeah, the Victorino one's an interesting one. You don't know quite what kind of player he is or if he's still the same guy that he was 2 short years ago. So, yeah, I mean, there's a case with Victorino where you know, you have a guy named Alan Craig sitting on the bench where this guy, you know, I firmly believe this guy could hit, but I also believe that this guy is not built to be a part-time player. And he doesn't have that kind of Brock Holt swing that has low maintenance where he can sit around for 3 or 4 days and then just come in and spray 3 line drives. I think Craig is the type of guy where needs to play regularly for you to see some of those results. Certainly Daniel Nava has been impressive whenever he's played this year, so that's a guy who could see more at bats. So, yeah, I think there is pressure on Shane Victorino. If he doesn't produce, you know, you have at the major league level, you have Alan Craig and you have Daniel Nava and you have Brock Holt who can take some of those at bats. And then down in AAA, Ruzne Castillo has a shoulder injury right now. Not quite sure when he's going to be back. But once he comes back, then you have another guy who could take some playing time. So, yeah, I think Shane Victorino is one of the biggest early season stories for this team, is just to see, you know, what he's going to do.
Again, pouring through the stats, and a number that jumped out at me is as good as the Red Sox relievers have been, they have the second most innings in the major leagues. That's always a concerning number, no matter how good or how deep your bullpen is. And it's, I think, particularly concerning this early in the year. What is the level of worry, first, just about the bullpen, particularly with a guy like Uehara, who is not somebody who can really be ridden that hard, with Ogando coming back from injury? Is that something they're aware of? Is that a concern, that workload that they're putting on the relievers right now?
Yeah, no, I think the stat is misleading in this sense, that you have to remember the Red Sox played a 19-inning game. So there was 14 bullpen innings right there in that game. And then that second turn through the rotation, 4 out of the 5 guys just kind of had terrible starts in that second turn through. And you hope it was just kind of a one-time slump through the rotation. So I wouldn't be alarmed about it yet, but if they have a few more turns through the rotation, we have 3 or 4 guys going 3 or 4 innings, then you have to look concerned. The good news is the bullpen has looked pretty good for the most part. Koji has looked good since coming back from the DL. Tozawa really continues to be a very underrated reliever who doesn't get a lot of hype around the game for whatever reason. Alexi Ogando, to me, he looks stronger each week. So I think they feel overall pretty good about their bullpen. But you're right, you never want a bullpen that's going to get overtaxed. And that's why the starting rotation, you know, they still have to prove it. There's been questions about this rotation ever since Ben Cherington constructed it in the winter. And it's been a little up and down so far. So, you know, John Farrell would like to see some more consistency out of this rotation.
And that does lead into my next question. For the early part of the season, it's clear that the Red Sox are very committed to these 5 guys. I mean, they it's sort of, to some extent, a group of equals. It's 5, you know, number 2s or number 3s or whatever they are. They pretty clearly separated them as these are our 5 guys. But if one or more of these guys continue to struggle, and look, the one guy I have the least faith in is the one guy who's pitching the best, Joe Kelly. You know, obviously Porcello's not going anywhere. You wouldn't think any of them would, but is there a plan B? What is plan B if there continues to be questions in this rotation?
Yeah, I thought all along the Red Sox felt, hey, the American League East is a little watered down this year. So we can compete with what we have right now. And, you know, you look at it up in the record as 9-5 through 14 games, so it's kind of gone how they thought. And then I think they've always thought, okay, we get to June, July, then we make a big move for a pitcher, whether it's a Cole Hamels or whoever, you know, whoever's out there at the time. I think that's the more likely scenario, that they're going to find somebody from another team. They're going to make a trade with some of the excess depth they have in other areas, rather than, say, calling a guy up. I don't really think they have that guy right now. Brian Johnson's looked pretty good, but I don't know if they want to rush him up. You know, Stephen Wright, is he really, you know, the answer to the pitch in this rotation? So I think that they're just going to keep seeing if they can compete in what they feel is a watered-down American League East. And that's how they're going to get through the first couple months of the season. And then, you know, if they really feel like, you know, that they're built to contend, then they go out and they try to get that starter who could put them over the top down the stretch.
All right. And finally, let's talk franchise 4. We got the early balloting results, and not particularly surprisingly, the 4 guys Red Sox fans have chosen thus far: Ted Williams, Yaz, David Ortiz, and Pedro. Out of that next tier of guys, one of my all-time favorite players, Dwight Evans, Carlton Fisk, Jim Rice, and Cy Young. Any of those guys you would slot in over the four currently leading?
Cy Young you'd certainly take a look at. And, look, I love Rice and Evans. Those are two guys that were in their primes when I was growing up watching the Red Sox. But the four guys you mentioned, it's hard to top really any of those four guys when you look at their resumes. And just the fact that Pedro was fourth behind David Ortiz, that shows you how competitive that is to be a top four Red Sox. You know, it just shows you the tradition that this franchise has. And I think that those four guys who are up there right now are very very worthy selections.
Do you think in particular, and I'm not sure, I'm just asking because I think it's an interesting question, that the one thing I would wonder, Pedro's got to be in there. Do you think there is any kind of a case for Rice over Ortiz at all? Do you think that's because of playing a position for a while, because of, I don't know, anything, or is it that number of games, number of at-bats, or do you think at this point that's pretty much a slam dunk?
Yeah, no, after I pretty much watched both of these guys their entire careers, Ortiz from the press box, Rice when I was growing up watching the Red Sox, and Jim Rice was certainly a great player when he was in his prime, but I think his prime wasn't as long as David Ortiz. David Ortiz has simply been a dominant player for longer than Jim Rice was, and I think that the defense, if Rice was a great defender, then maybe you make a case there, but he was kind of a mediocre left fielder. I think what David Ortiz has done kind of leading this team to really three World Series championships, where you can't really say that about any other slugger in Red Sox, modern day Red Sox history, or even going back to when Ted Williams played. So I think that's kind of what puts Ortiz over the top against Jim Rice.
Brian, it's the thing I think that was the biggest variable that had to work for this team to be good was the rotation had to be good and had to be healthy. And over this last basically single turn through the rotation, they've been pretty effective. How is this? I mean, again, everything is just a few games, but is this a pretty encouraging thing? Do you like what you're seeing from the Yankee starters here lately?
Sure, it is only a few games, but you can only go off what you've seen so far. And what you've seen so far is that the Yankees are getting good starting pitching. I think that you saw big things from Nathan Eovaldi his third time out there. He made a little adjustment against the Tigers, and that is no picnic to go into Detroit and face that kind of lineup. So to be able to do what he did last night, made a little adjustment. The slider was a little tighter for him. That's very encouraging because he's one of the guys you look at the career win-loss, you look at the numbers and you say, wow, well, how with that kind of stuff, how is this guy not winning more games? Well, this is what the Yankees are hoping, that he's kind of a late bloomer. It takes starting pitching time to develop. He's still very young. I mean, this is not a 29, 30-year-old guy. This is not a finished product. So the Yankees are hoping the best years are ahead, and that's one reason they made that trade for him. And then you're seeing encouraging things from Tanaka, who looked like the guy he was last season down in St. Pete. That was a big outing for him, I think, just for his confidence, his state of mind, to know that's still in there, that's still in the tank. And CeCe, I know that the numbers are not coming, the wins are not coming, but it's hard to ask a whole lot more than what they've already gotten out of CeCe this year. If he can keep that up, I really do believe that the numbers are going to turn around. What jumps out to me most is the strikeout to walk ratio. He is really pounding the zone. He's learning to pitch in this second stage of this career, and he knows that, look, the 96, 97 velocities, that's not going to come back. But if he can replicate what Andy Pettit was in the tail end of Andy's career, the Yankees would sign up for that in a heartbeat.
And again, kind of scouting the stats here, but Sabathia's last outing seemed, certainly the results were better. I mean, he walked three as opposed to one total in the first two starts, but was he noticeably different, or was it kind of just more things fell a little better and he pitched the same as the previous outing?
I think the lineup was better that he faced. I mean, that is a tough lineup, 1-9, to go into Detroit and face that lineup on their home turf. So I think, yeah, there were some balls that he got helped out by the defense. He turned a few double plays there behind him. I think that, look, if he can go in and give his team eight innings of two-run ball against a team like the Tigers, which has just really been mashing this year, not so much of late, but, look, that lineup can hit. I think the Yankees will take that out of what really is going to be their number three starter in Sabathia. If he can give them that kind of outing every fifth day, they'll take that.
can't talk Yankees without talking A-Rod. I think we expected, I expected, and I think we talked about this, so, you know, kind of maybe he'd look like the guy the last time we saw him healthy, which was a guy who got on base but didn't really hit for a lot of power. He's crushing the ball. That, to me, is the most striking thing. It's not that he's getting some base hits. It's not that he's getting on base. It's that he's hitting the ball really far. Is this a surprise to you to see the power that he's showing early this year?
It's a little surprising, yeah. You saw a little bit of it in spring training. You didn't know how it was going to translate in the regular season. You know, when you get in these bigger ballparks, outdoor weather, cold weather. Look, he's proving one thing that he is proving is he can still catch up to a fastball with the best of them. So I think people were thinking they'd come into the season and bring in a guy who throws 95 and up and get away with it against Alex, and that just hasn't proven to be the case. Look, he's striking out quite a bit. I think I saw a number, it's over 30% of his at-bats have been strikeouts. That's way above his career average. So he is susceptible to some things. It's not like he's a superhuman force here in the lineup. The average has dipped below 300 again. I think that, look, as we've been saying, he would have helped that lineup a lot last year. Being there, he would have played every day. He would have DH'd. He could have filled in the corners, and he would have been one of the most productive players in that lineup last year. It's turning out to be that way so far. Look, he said you've got to do it over the course of a full season, and let's look up in September and see where he's at. I agree with that, but it's hard to imagine him getting off to a much better start here as April turns into May. The Yankees, for everything that's happened in the headlines and everything we've talked about, he's helping them win games. And so I think that he has certainly become a force in that lineup. And obviously Girardi has elevated him now. He's been in the three hole. He belongs there. He's proving that he belongs there. And he's proving he can still hit major league pitching.
If a reasonable expectation for him coming into the year was maybe 270, 360 on base, 15, 20 home runs, and I think, you know, I think that's probably fair. Right? If people would have ended up on different sides of that, but that's probably basically an aggregate, maybe mildly optimistic take for him coming into the year. Is there any part of that that just based on 2 weeks you think we really should adjust? Maybe the home runs, or do you still think that at the end of the year, that's probably about what he's going to look like when we get to September?
To me, I'll stay there. You know, who knows for sure, but I'll stay there just based on it is a marathon, not a sprint. You've heard it so many times. Something could happen at some point. Look, he's 39 and a half years old, going on 40. He's going to need some days off here and there. There's going to be bumps and bruises and wear and tear. But if he does stay in this DH role and Girardi does keep the communication up, which is something that he's very good about, and if Alex is honest about taking a day when he needs a day, and you know, you would think that the DHing will keep him fresher than if he had to play 140, 150 games at third base, because that's just not realistic at this point. I think he should get the at-bats to put up those kind of numbers, and you know, maybe the home run total can exceed 15. Maybe you can get into the 20s. I really would hesitate to extrapolate it over the course of a full season and say he's going to hit 30 or 40 bombs. But I think that there's no reason he can't continue to be this level of productive and really help out the Yankees lineup.
We turn our focus now to the bullpen. Dellin Betances' last few starts, again, the numbers look awfully good. Look like the guy we're kind of used to seeing. He's basically cut out the walks. He's striking guys out. Does he look sorted out to you?
The velocity's come back, too. I think that people were worried about that in spring training because he wasn't lighting up the radar gun the way you saw it during July and August of last year. But the Yankees had said they were looking at his readings from last spring, and he was actually above where he was then. So maybe it just took a little bit more time to come back together. It's something where he has been relying a little bit more on the breaking ball than previously seen. I think it's something where if he's throwing it for strikes and getting swings and misses on it, well, keep it up. There's no reason why he has to rear back and try and throw a 97 past everybody. With that fastball, curve, slurve, combo, whatever you want to call it, he can get a lot of swings and misses and outs. And it's interesting to see how this has evolved with Girardi now. Miller is the one getting the save opportunities. He's got five of them now. But you can make the argument that Betances is coming into the hairier parts of the lineup. There was that game against the Rays down at the Trop where Dylan had to come in and get five outs there, and he had to face the heart of the lineup. So Miller was saying that night, Dylan may not have gotten the save, but he did the more important job there. So this is kind of what we've been talking about. I thought it was going to flip the other way. I was wrong on that. I thought that Miller would get the eighth and Betances would get the ninth, but it's working this way. There's no reason for Girardi to flip it right now. So I can see them continuing to go with this for quite a while.
One more question about the current Yankees. How long can they keep up this bullpen revolving door thing where guys not only come in and out of the major league roster, but on and off the 40 and in some cases in and out of the organization entirely? I would assume it's not something they want to continue, but how long do you see the bullpen stabilizing at some point?
Yeah, you don't want to have to keep having that revolving door. And you know, that's why you do have the pitchers down at AAA that you can bring up during the course of the year. But that 19-inning game against Boston really hurt. And it took that long to just come back from that. You had to wait for Esmiel Rogers to come back. So you had revolving door guys like Chasen Shreve, who is now finally back. I mean, Shreve, in his case, he didn't do anything wrong to get sent down, except he did his job pretty well. A couple of years ago, Adam Warren did the same thing out in Oakland and wind up pitching five, six innings against the A's in an extra inning game that seemed to go on forever, and his reward for that was getting sent down to AAA. But, you know, so this is kind of the thing Girardi has talked about. It's always an uncomfortable conversation. You don't want to have it because the pitchers didn't do anything wrong. He's had to have that conversation quite a few times this year, but if they can stay out of those extra inning games and keep the long reliever stable and have Esmiel Rogers do that job and not have to pawn the job off on other people, maybe they can keep the revolving door down a little bit. But I think the important thing is they're getting results out of guys like not just Miller, Betances, but David Carpenter. Obviously, he had the one blip in Baltimore, but on the whole, he's been pretty good. And Justin Wilson has looked pretty good in the limited amounts of time he's been on the mound. So they're getting contributions throughout that bullpen. And Miller put it well. He said that no matter how you align it, they should have seven guys there that can come in and do the job. And people were talking about the bullpen being one of the strengths of the Yankees this year, and I think it's shaping up to be that.
And then finally, let's talk a little bit of franchise four. The Yankees the first round of balloting was just announced, and the four Yankees on the outs could be the four for some clubs. Ruth, Gehrig, Mantle, DiMaggio in. Barra, Ford, Jeter, and Rivera not currently in. What's your four? Do you go with the four, the sort of canonized four that the fans have gone with so far, or would you put one of those guys currently on the outs in the top four?
Gosh, that is so tough. I mean, the Yankees do not make it easy here, do they? Can we make it a franchise eight or something? Look, Ruth is bigger than the game. You got to go with him, I think. Gehrig, you've got to go there. DiMaggio, how do you say no to DiMaggio? Mantle. I would love to be able to make the case for you. I mean, it really stinks to leave Yogi off that. I'd love to make the case to you that you could put Jeter or Rivera in there, but the guys who came before, that's the Yankees. I mean, Jeter and Rivera belong in the conversation for sure, but I don't see how I can take any one of those four out. So I think the fans are getting it right. It's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to look at the Yankees' Mount Rushmore and say that Jeter and Rivera, sorry, there's no place for you on it, but I'm having a really tough time doing that and disagreeing with the fans. So I think they're doing a good job with it. It's a tough assignment for sure.
Yogi to me is the toughest guy out of there to keep out. And I really can see a case to bump Mantle for Yogi, but again,
yeah.
You'd be bumping Mickey, Flip, and Mantle.
Yeah, man. It's just, what do you do? I'm glad that somebody else is making that decision and it's not up to me because that's a tough call to make.
The B-Riders answer, and I say that not critically. I use it plenty myself. Glad it's not my decision. Gregory, as we speak, it is the morning after some highly entertaining conversations at Rogers Center last night, at least if you don't have a rooting stake. What's this all about? This apparently goes back a while between the Orioles and Blue Jays. What's the story here?
Yeah, there's some bad blood between these two teams now dating back a couple of years, and it really kind of started between two guys, Darren O'Day and Jose Bautista. There was some words exchanged all the way back in 2013 where O'Day struck out Bautista and had a few words for him on his way off the mound. I think he had taken exception a little bit to some of Jose's supposed antics at the plate previously. And then the very next day after that, Bautista faced Darren O'Day again, and this time instead of striking out, he went deep. And that kind of started another war of words as he was rounding the bases. And then this is something we've seen continue. Darren O'Day and Bautista have had multiple kind of flare-ups since then. And then I think both teams got into it a little bit more late last year when there was a situation where Marcus Stroman threw over the head of Caleb Joseph, and that added to some more bad blood, and we've seen it carry over this year. So it really kind of started off with just two guys, but I think now, as last night was an example of, I think it's kind of being really felt through the entire dugouts in both teams, really 1 through 25, each guy. It seems like there's some real animosity, which has kind of really added something to the to a rivalry that wasn't really a rivalry before. I mean, usually with the Jays and Jays fans, you kind of think of the Yankees and the Red Sox, and not too many people think of the Orioles, but that seems to be the case now.
In my experience, and admittedly my experience may be unusual, but in my experience, this stuff doesn't happen, for the most part, without the managers having some, if not control, some say in the tone. I guess what I'm saying is managers can make this happen, and to some extent, managers can kind of quiet it down. Is there anything between the two managers? Is there, if nothing else, it doesn't seem like they're trying to quiet it down any. Is this something that at this point at least goes beyond the players to where the two managers have any kind of issue?
Well, I think it certainly does, at least from the Orioles side on this, because Bautista is well aware of some of Showalter's comments that he's made. Showalter, it seems like whenever this happens, I mean, you know Showalter as well. He can be sometimes a very great quote. And he's had some derogatory things to say about Bautista and the way that he approaches the game, and that's something Bautista has noticed. And so I think there's been a bit of a war of words there. And even last night, Bautista referenced it in his post-game interview. He kind of said that he thinks that the Orioles kind of, you know, as long as their manager conducts the way he himself on the field and off the field, the way he does, he doesn't think this is going away anytime soon. So clearly there's it's become a little bit personal on that end. Gibbons hasn't really gotten involved too much. He was very upset last night when they threw at Bautista for the second time in as many weeks and came out and argued, but he hasn't really had a whole lot to say during this entire thing. So he's kind of been staying out of it. I think that's going to have to change now, because I don't think this is going to go away anytime soon. But with the exception of the one pitch by Marcus Stroman last year, this has really been more on the Orioles side with the Blue Jays hitters. The Jays pitchers haven't gotten involved too much, with the exception of that one Stroman thing. Now, if the Jays pitchers get involved either later this series or the next time the Blue Jays go to Baltimore, then certainly you're going to see Gibbons' impact all over that as well.
And that kind of leads in the next thing I want to talk about. I mean, I don't want to be the "won't somebody please think of the children" person. But, you know, this stuff can get more ugly than it's gotten. I mean, there's a point to which you definitely do not want this to go. And as much as jawing can be entertaining, especially when it's real stars talking to each other, there's a point that you really don't want it to get to. And so my follow-up is I do wonder at what point do the managers talk, do the organizations talk? Is there some sort of player emissary to where you get to a point that you can kind of diffuse it and make sure that it doesn't go from guys jawing each other to people getting hurt?
Yeah, and that's a great point, because as we've seen kind of with the A's Royal series recently as well, I mean, things can get out of hand in a hurry. And you know, this probably would be a very different situation as well if Bautista had actually been hit. I mean, this is the second time they threw behind him, so neither time were they actually able to connect. And that's a good thing if you're a Jays fan, because you don't want to see Bautista getting dinged by baseball. But, this is definitely in danger of being escalated. I don't know if it's going to happen this immediate series. Wouldn't be surprised if this is something that continues on, later on in Baltimore, later on this year. I just think with Major League Baseball keeping such probably a close eye in this situation, the umpires are going to be all over it in this current series. that it might be something that happens later. But you're right. I mean, both sides probably would be best served to try and hash this out separately. But it just seems like this has been going on now for so long. I mean, the fact that this dates all the way back to 2013, I would have thought that the offseason away, after the apology Stroman gave last year and everything that happened there, I would have thought an offseason away would have been enough to get away from all of this. And then it really kind of caught me by surprise when Darren O'Day threw that pitch during the Orioles home opener series. That kind of, I think, caught a lot of people off guard and really kind of flare things up again. And so far, the Blue Jays haven't necessarily retaliated except with Batista's bat. But if they ever decide to retaliate and actually throw at somebody on the Orioles team, then this could get ugly in a hurry.
Okay, there's some actual baseball stuff I do want to get to, so I don't want to go too far down this road. Rogers Center is a good place to hit. It's not Coors Field. It's not it's not like hitting on the moon or something. It's a good place to hit. But for several years now, this team has absolutely raked at home, much more than the park factors would suggest. If we put aside the man in white stuff, what is it that makes this team so effective with the bats at home?
That's interesting. And the ball travels really, really well at Rogers Center. As you said, it's not Coors Field, but it really is. It's a ballpark that the Blue Jays have kind of built their team around. I mean, it's ideally suited for guys like Batista and Encarnacion. I think it's really suited for a guy like Donaldson, especially after playing in Oakland for as long as for the past few years and coming over. Even guys like Justin Smoke, where a lot of fly balls kind of would end up, you know, relatively deep outfield at Safeco, but not really be in danger of going out. A lot of times those balls can carry. And it's, I think in the past, when it wasn't the home runs, I think the turf, the fast turf that the Jays had there played a factor as well. It's a turf that in the past played a lot faster than Tropicana Field. I think with a slower surface this year, that'll change things a little bit. But, I mean, the ball can really just fly out of Rogers Center, and this is a team that really has been built on home runs now, even dating well back before Alex Anthopoulos' tenure. But it's something I think the club has made a conscious decision, though, to find guys who fit well in that ballpark, and they might not be good fits on other teams because of ballpark factors elsewhere. But when you bring them into Toronto, it kind of suits them a little bit better.
And also, I wanted to get, we talked about this every week, but it seems like it's getting closer and closer. What's the latest on Michael Saunders?
Yeah, Saunders, is the positive news for the Jays, and that it looks like he'll join them Friday in St. Petersburg against the Rays. It's the original plan was to have him kind of advance through the minor league system and go on a rehab assignment, not only with Class A Dunedin, but also work his way up through Triple A Buffalo. That plan changed, and it's really because of the timing of the schedule more than anything else. The Blue Jays are going down to Tampa. Dunedin is a very short drive from there, so Saunders will just make the short drive over and join the team there. So the one disadvantage he has coming in is that he won't have faced a very high level of competition. He won't even have been able to kind of get up and face AAA pitchers. But the Jays seem pretty confident that the timing at the plate isn't going to be a big issue for him, because while he wasn't able to do much running and wasn't able to do much work in the field, he, for the most part throughout this entire thing, was still able to get at bats. And even dating back into spring training, he was taking at bats and just not running the bases. And so the Jays think that'll come along relatively quickly, and that's good news for a team that, you know, for as much as there was positive stories early on about guys like Kevin Pillar and to a lesser extent Dalton Pompey, I think the shine's wearing off on Pillar a little bit. He struggled lately, and it kind of makes sense now to have a guy like Saunders kind of come in and assume the role that everybody thought he was going to be in on an everyday basis.
And then finally, I wanted to run by you because we are talking about this everywhere. It's the MLB Franchise 4 initiative. Wanted to ask, get your take. If you were to vote, and perhaps you already have, perhaps you are such a enthusiast that you've already gone ahead and voted. I find the Blue Jays one of the more interesting ones. It's not maybe as obvious as some. Who would be your four out of Roberto Alomar, Jose Bautista, George Bell, Joe Carter, Carlos Delgado, Tony Fernandez, Roy Halladay, and Dave Steeb?
Well, it really is one of the more intriguing ones I found as well, and it's I think Alomar is a no-brainer, even though he didn't have that long of a career in Toronto. Just the timing of where he when he played here, and the fact that he went into the Hall of Fame wearing a Blue Jays cap, I think you automatically have to go with him. Roy Halladay to me is the best pitcher to ever put on a Blue Jays uniform, and I was a big Dave Steed fan growing up, and Dave Steed had a lot of great years, but I give the edge to Halladay on that one. And Carlos Delgado to me is another no-brainer. I mean, I was a little bit surprised that he didn't receive a little bit more attention in the Hall of Fame voting this past year. I didn't think he would get in, but and I didn't think he was going to get in, but I was surprised that he was a guy who was removed after the first ballot, because he really did put up some very strong numbers. And then the final one would be, right now the vote is going to Joe Carter, and I completely understand why, because of his infamous home run and everything that he meant to baseball in Canada during the early 90s. But when you look at the numbers, I think Jose Bautista is starting to make a strong case for that. And Bautista hasn't had any exposure to the postseason or anything like that that Carter did back in the day. But when you start looking at just the overall leaders in a lot of offensive categories, I mean, Bautista is really putting his kind of name all over that. And if you look at spots like WAR, I mean, he's got a chance to be a guy who has the highest of anyone who's ever really played for this team. So I think those would be my four guys. I think I would go Alomar, Bautista, Halladay, and Carlos Delgado.
Brett, I'm going to start by asking you the same thing I asked Gregor Chisholm this week. Why can't these two teams get along? This thing goes back a little while now. What's the story from the Orioles' perspective with the Orioles and Blue Jays?
I think, the Orioles were kind of a little off put by the way that Jose Bautista reacted. You mentioned he has a little bit of history. Most of that is with reliever Darren O'Day. I think that they just don't like kind of the showiness, similar to kind of a David Ortiz that they feel like he exhibits whenever he hits a home run. They're just not that kind of club. They take offense to that. And obviously what you saw in Toronto was much of the same. And then when you add to the fact that the Rule 5 draft, that Jason Garcia was on the mound, and Adam Jones felt the need to kind of stick up for him, felt like he had to kind of show the back for the rookies. So, it's an interesting scenario. I don't think by any means it's to the scope of something like the Kansas City Royals. I just think the Orioles are very off put with the way that Bautista has acted over the past couple of meetings.
I think that's a good point to make, because as long as it doesn't get really ugly, to some extent, drawing can be fun, and of course I like bat flips, and I like people who have fun playing the game. But as long as it kind of doesn't boil over, I think this kind of thing is good. But the fact that it hasn't really gone away in a year and a half, I think, can lead to a little worry that maybe at some point it does boil over a little. And so I think my next question is, at what point do the managers or the front offices or Jones and Bautista or somebody kind of take a minute to kind of make a connection and say, hey, okay, let's not let this go any further. Let's kind of end this, or is there not any interest in making that happen?
From the Orioles end, I don't think there's any interest in Buck kind of saying, hey, let's end this. That's not really his style anyway. I think he trusts in his guys. He likes them to show their personality, their emotion, as long as they're smart about it. And, if a player pops off and things come out of hand and they get ejected, then I think then it becomes a separate matter. But Buck feels like the players need to police themselves, so I really don't see him saying much of anything.
All right. That was just one part of what was not a particularly enjoyable trip for the Orioles. They, after getting off to a pretty good start to the year, dropped 6 of 7 against what it seems pretty likely to be the two teams they'll be battling most for the division title, Boston and Toronto. Just kind of broadly, what happened on this trip, aside from running into two good teams and two tough places to play?
Right. Well, their starters haven't gone 6 innings or more in, I think it's 8 straight games now. So that really crushes you. And then when you take into account the fact that their bullpen, they can't make the roster moves that traditionally they've been able to make, to supplement guys, give some of their arms a little bit of a blow, so they haven't been able to do that. And then it seems like every injury it just keeps piling on them. I mean, I know every team deals with injury, but Scott Leaders and J.J. Hardy are both out. I think they expected both of them to be there by the end of April. Add that to the fact that Jonathan Scope is going to be sidelined for an extended amount of time, of course, with that knee issue. Then you have the latest one, which, of course, is Ryan Flaherty, another infielder dealing with a groin issue. Looks like it could be a DL situation we'll see today. So you're really looking at a lot of people down for the Orioles, which is unfortunate. And I think that when you look at that lineup, it's tough to really fill in for some of those roles. Some of those guys are such a big part of the club. That combined with the pitching not doing well is really what set up such a forgettable road trip for them.
Yeah, and I don't want to pick on one guy, but you talk about the starters, and you know, the guy that really it seems like they kind of need to be able to halt those things and get some innings and do be that guy who kind of stops those slumps is Chris Tillman. And he's got a couple of good starts, but he has two really rough starts, and he's walked 13 batters in 4 starts. There was a little of this last year. He had a little stretch where he was, you know, the strikeout to walk wasn't so good, and he kind of turned it up as the year went on. But what's going on with him that so far this year he's not really the guy that they expect to see, at least on a consistent basis?
I just think early on in the game is when he kind of left it get away from him. If he's good the first 2 innings, it's usually indicative of a good outing. You know, like a lot of pitchers, he's still kind of trying to figure it out, I think, early on in the game, trying to get a feel for his stuff. And he's really hasn't been able to do that and get on track. And you look at some of the teams that they've faced and they've slotted up against, and, you know, he hasn't been able to get out of these innings without his pitch count up real high or a bunch of runs allowed, things like that. So when you look at that, he hasn't been able to rebound. To me, the bigger concern is probably Bud Norris, if you're going to look at the rotation and kind of say, who needs to step up? I know Tillman is the guy, is their opening day starter, but at what point in time do you have to do something about Bud Norris, who hasn't had a good outing yet this year?
So let me ask you that, because I think that is a good question, particularly for a club that's got a pretty exciting alternative who, you know, every week that Kevin Gausman isn't starting, it gets harder to get him, you know, stretched out, and maybe it becomes, I'm not saying they wouldn't, but, you know, every the farther it gets from spring training, the harder it is to sort of throw Gausman in for a start here or there. Are we anywhere near decision time? Is that a matter of weeks, a matter of months? Where are they with Norris's struggles?
I think it has to be a matter of weeks. I mean, if you're trying to win, you're trying to win this year. Look at a team that's got, it looks like, about 11 free agents at the end of the season. You can't afford to go months. I know it's early and it's April, but you just can't be buried early on by the schedule. So I think that the leash is getting shorter and shorter on Norris. I would say maybe a couple more starts at the most. They really need to figure out what they have here. And, you know, they got to figure out a way to get Bud Norris right, because the team needs him and Gausman to be pitching well. But, yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head. They have such a good alternative. It makes you think how much longer before they go to that alternative, before they try out Kevin Gausman, because he's going to be a starter for them this year. And they don't want to limit his innings. Part of the reason they had him start off in the bullpen. But, you know, it's been a few weeks. The team is struggling. They need kind of a shot in the arm. Maybe Kevin Gausman can be just that.
And again, just looking at the game logs, I mean, he seems to be, you know, last time we talked, he was coming off an outing that the line looked worse than it was. But, you know, back-to-back, 2 shutout inning appearances, it seems like he's sort of doing a nice job of saying, hey, guys, don't forget about me.
Yeah, he is. He, you know, he had a couple of rough outings in the beginning. I mean, it's tough for a reliever because you have one bad outing and, you know, it takes you months for your ERA to go back down. But he does look like he's settling in a little bit. That bullpen had a rough go in general. I think people don't realize how tough it is coming out of spring training, especially for relievers, when the situation and the atmosphere is just so different. But yeah, he's starting to look like Kevin Gausman again, which is obviously really good for the Orioles.
Another little piece of good news here is it does look like, not just with the 2 home runs, but it looks like over the last week or so, Manny Machado is finding his stroke. What are you seeing from him at the plate?
Yeah, he is. And, you know, again, it's early, but he seems to kind of be like his old self again. And last year he never looked like that. He never looked fully healthy, fully recovered. He missed the first month of the season, of course, but, you know, he just never looked to be like that young, exciting player that he had so much hope for. So I think he's finally got both legs under him. He's finally feeling okay, and you're starting to see what Manny Machado can do, what he can bring to this club. because he grows into his body more, I think you're going to start to see that power more often on display. But it's certainly been good to see because they haven't had a whole lot to feel good about lately.
And finally, I want to talk a little franchise four with you here. The Orioles are seem to me to have five very strong candidates, maybe six depending on how you look at it. Cal Ripken Jr., Brooks Robinson, Jim Palmer, and Frank Robinson, all awfully hard to leave out. And then yet you look at Eddie Murray, Boog Powell. If it were up to you, any of those four who are in that you would bump out for any of the guys who are currently out?
Oh, gosh, I can't bump out any of those. I'll be crucified in Baltimore. I think you got to go with those four. It's, like you mentioned, it's tough, but I don't see how you could talk about Orioles baseball without mentioning any of those names.
It's pretty amazing. There got to be 20 teams where Eddie Murray would not only be on the list, but pushing for the top. That's an awfully nice list that they've got there. Bill, let's start, as we have so many times recently, with the injury update. Sounded like some encouraging news on Jake McGee recently. How close is he getting?
Well, he's close, but we've got to see what happens. He turned it loose himself when he pitched on Thursday in an extended spring game, and his back tightened a little bit. So they're kind of waiting to see how he kind of recuperates from that, but they don't really consider it a setback, and neither does Jake. So he's still thinking, you know, end of April 1st of May type thing on that. So we could see him pretty soon.
Drew Smyly chugging along in rehab starts. How close is he?
Well, he actually told a Times reporter last night that he was going to be ready on Friday, but the Rays have not officially announced it. And last time the Rays talked about it with me, they were saying that he would probably do four rehab starts instead of three. So it's Friday. I mean, his next start would be a rehab start on Friday. So we'll see. They should tell us something on that today.
But either way, that's certainly sounds good. It's imminent one way or another. He's one guy who's in a good place. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Throughout his rehab, he's not had any setbacks, and all it's been is a matter of building up his pitch count.
And then the last guy on the pitching side, Colomé, is seems like, again, getting closer, but he's had such a weird year. Is he a little bit harder to read than some of the other guys, given all the number of things and how little spring he had and all that?
Yeah, I think he is, but, you know, he's not coming back from an arm thing. It was pneumonia. So it's kind of a thing where they've been trying to build him back up. So I think we're going to see him pretty close at the same time with Steve Smyly, which will give a huge boost to the team getting both those guys back, because they've really been naked in the last two spots of the rotation.
On the offensive side, there does seem to be some good news. James Loney is almost back. Any reason to think he won't be his normal self when he comes back?
I don't think there's any reason not to believe that. He told us last night that he expects to be back by the weekend. Now, whether that's Friday or Saturday remains to be seen. I know he thought he only needed to play one rehab game, whereas Kevin Sass said he might need to play two. But that's potato, potato, I guess, as far as that goes. He should give them a big boost back. I know last night, just digging in the field, the one unearned run that was scored, you got to believe that he's going to pick that ball at first. Forsythe gave it a good shot, but that's not really Forsythe's position. So who knows what might happen if Loney had been even in the field last night, because he is a really slick fielder.
He's not a big thunder bat, but he is an above-average, useful major league hitter for a team that right now is really in need of some offense. He should be a fairly significant boost to the lineup, shouldn't he?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, like you say, it's not it's not the home run, but I think there's one reason he kind of fit in here initially. He's never been the 20 home run guy, but he slaps it around the ballpark and he doesn't strike out. And again, his defense is above average defense. And we've seen a lot of good first basemen here at Tampa, and I'm telling you, he's right up there at the top with them.
Yeah, I mean, he's almost a guy that's more valuable now than ever before as contact goes down, strikeouts go up, singles go down. A guy who can just get a base hit, 10 years ago, that's not a guy who has that much value. In an era where singles are at a premium, that's a pretty valuable skill in 2015.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, you know, the change in the landscape of offense is definitely, a coveted thing to have a guy you can put in the lineup and he can, you know, get the hits. Because particularly as young as the lineup is for Hayes, even though I think we've had some nice surprises in the lineup so far, just having that constant presence. I mean, he's not Longoria, but he is, you know, a steady bat that, you know, is a tough out.
And you set me up perfectly because my next question is about Evan Longoria. Again, it's still really early, but he's the most important guy in this lineup, and he's still not hitting. I guess it's not time to worry yet, but how long does this go before it is somewhat time to worry?
Well, you know, personally, I wouldn't be concerned about it because I didn't think it's really, you know, the best player on the team. But then again, I think it's fair dialogue based on his time in Mongolia-like numbers last year and the fact that he played the entire season. So, maybe if this thing moves on a couple more weeks and he's not hitting, it will really become a concern. Although, Sash asked about that the other night, and he said, you know, the swings have been good and the pitch selection, you know, and the whole bit. But, you know, you never know if the guy just covers for his player either.
Got three regulars who were expected to be pretty significant contributors: Desmond Jennings, Asdrubal Cabrera, Rene Rivera, all under 200. And I know batting average isn't everything, but I also know when you're hitting under 200, it's pretty hard to be productive. With any of those guys, are there any options other than just to wait for them to turn it around?
Well, I know last night they started Beckham at shortstop, and he's one of the young guys I was telling you about that's kind of been a pleasant surprise. For those not familiar with him, he was number one pick at the 2008 draft. And, he's had a pretty hard road to hoe based on, who was up in that draft. You know, Buster Posey and the Rays could have had him, blah, blah, blah. But, he's still a kid, and he's showing some offense. So, you know, he's somebody they can plug in there a little bit. But Cabrera last night, Dan Cass talked about him. He said, he didn't go through some little spurts, anything like that, but, he seems to pick it back up. As far as Rivera goes, the funny thing is, it's such a low bar based on catching with the Rays over the last couple of years that I was joking with someone the other night just based on his defense. I mean, he looks like Johnny Bench based on, what they've had back there. So his first priority, obviously, is the catching duty. Jennings, the last week he's kind of gone down, but he started out hitting the ball well, and that's kind of made it the cycle too, because he hit the ball off, he was nailing it all spring, so you just can't do that for 2 months usually.
One bright spot on the offensive side, Logan Forsythe is off to a pretty nice start, and he's an interesting guy because he's not brand new to the majors. This is his fifth season in the majors, but he was an on-base machine at every level of the minor leagues. Despite the fact that we've seen nearly 1,000 at-bats of this guy already, do you think there's reason to think that he really could emerge this year and be, probably not be the power guy he's shown so far, but at least be a quality guy with on-base ability who could maybe be a table setter at the top of the order?
Well, I think the more we see him, the more we'll find that out. You always hear scouts talk about if a player is being exposed when he's in the lineup a lot. The other side of that is, you talk to any player, and in order to have good, positive results, normally you want to be in that lineup and seeing pitching every day. So this is a good opportunity for him to show what he has. I know I'm impressed with what a professional he is. And he's actually a really good fielder out there, second base. So that's going to be fun to watch to see what he does in the next month or two.
I want to wrap up by talking franchise four. Most of the Rays' choices are pretty obvious, and you might make a case that all four of them are obvious. But in this first round of balloting, the top four: Evan Longoria, David Price, James Shields, Ben Zobrist. The guys currently on the outs: Carl Crawford, Scott Kazmir, Carlos Pena, and the man who, when he was in St. Petersburg, was B.J. Upton. If it were up to you, any of those four guys who are not in the top four that you would put in the top four, or is that a pretty much a slam dunk with those four they've got?
Well, for me, I might even put Crawford number one. It just shocks me that he's not in that top four. But Hammock's presence on the team. I think it's maybe a little bit of a taste of what have you done for me lately, because this guy was just the real deal when he was with the Rays.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.